But.
So you're saying there's never been a case where you drank so much that you didn't remember what happened the night before or part of what happened?
That's, you're asking about, yeah, blackout. I don't know. Have you?
Could you answer the question, Judge? That's not happened. Is that your answer?
Yeah, and I'm curious if you have.
I have no drinking problem, Judge.
Yeah, nor do I.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Amy Klobuchar and Brett Kavanaugh at his confirmation hearings back in September. That's when many Americans learned just who Senator Amy Klobuchar is. On Sunday, she announced her candidacy for president. But she has been dogged by stories that, despite her Minnesota nice persona in private, she can be a mean and exacting boss. Or is that just sexism talking? Amy Edmondson teaches leadership and management at the Harvard Business School. She joins us now. Hi there.
Hi.
Also joining us is Colby Itkowitz, political reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome to you.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Colby, let's begin with you. What are the accusations against Senator Klobuchar in terms of how she treats her staff?
Sure. There's been several stories now by national media looking at Senator Klobuchar's treatment of her staff. And basically, it comes down to a few things. One is just being really demeaning and demoralizing, criticizing their work in really harsh ways, saying things like, I've never seen writing this bad, or I've never seen something handed into me that was this terrible. And also, there's been rumors of her asking her staff to do things above and beyond the call of the actual job, things like her laundry and her dishes. And again, whether or not these are all rumors, these are all allegations, but these are what former staffers have told reporters about their time working for the senator.
And what's been her response?
Her response so far, the only thing we've heard was on Sunday when she made her announcement, someone asked her about it, and she said that she can be a very demanding boss, but that she also demands a lot from herself and she demands a lot from this country. But she didn't go into specifics about the individual accusations.
Okay, Amy, let's bring you in here. What do you make of this as someone who teaches management and leadership and knows a lot about it? Is this something that we hear a lot of when it comes to female bosses?
It is something we hear a lot of, and it's such a puzzling phenomenon. Mean and exacting are not the same thing, and yet they are often said in one mouthful as if they are the same thing. Mean is clearly not a positive attribute of any boss or any person. Exacting is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think many of us aspire to work for people who hold high standards and believe in us and will help us get there.
Right.
As your question notes, there is a gender aspect here. There's a gender challenge.
Right. And so how do you, when you are teaching this and maybe teaching young men and women how to be bosses, how do you teach them to be exacting without being mean, especially if they're women and they have to be perceived as, or at least they're expected to be perceived as nice?
I try to convey to aspiring managers what it means to get the best, how do you get the best performance from someone? And it's a combination of conveying that the work we are doing together matters, it's meaningful, it's making the world a better place, that there's sort of a motivation that you want people to have, and then also conveying what good looks like. And that's where the exacting comes in, saying, this is an example of, a superb report. This is an example of a report with missing pieces. So you do want to be specific. You want to convey to people that you believe they are capable of high standards, and you want to give them specific feedback on when and how they are reaching them or not reaching them. There's no real place for meanness in mm-hmm. there. Now, there is the possibility, and it often happens, that people will see that as mean. And I'm not making a specific statement one way or another about Senator Klobuchar, but I am saying that oftentimes, for those of you who have children, you know that if you tell them, they should pick up their room, they might accuse you of being mean.
Right.
When in fact you're being exacting. So,
right. It's all in how you do it, though.
It's all in how you
humiliate them. You just tell them what you want and expect them to achieve.
Precisely. And humiliation almost never gets you the real results you want, because the real results you want is for people to internalize the goals, to internalize the high aspirations that you seek to inspire. and to want to do that themselves.
And Colby, Washington is a very high pressure place, very, very, very competitive. Is this something that's common? You hear this a lot, that staffers are expected to, I don't know, that they have really difficult times, stressful times working for their bosses, that their bosses, whether male or female, can be exacting and or mean.
Absolutely. It is a very high-pressure place. It's also filled with a lot of type A people, people that are desperate to, rise up in ranks and to please, they're people pleasers, those types. And so they are willing to kind of go above and beyond for their bosses. So if their member of Congress says, go take my dog for a walk or go pick up my dry cleaning or I need you to run this errand that's completely unrelated to legislating, they're more than willing to jump at the chance to do it. And so we've known this for forever. And you always have heard kind of whisper campaigns about which bosses are the toughest. The only actual data set we have for that is staff turnover. If staff turnover is in fact an indication of a difficult work environment, then Senator Klobuchar has always ranked at the top of that list. She has consistently been, number one or number two or three in having the most staff turnover in the Senate. So it is widespread, and I think there is a legitimate question to be asked about gender, because if it is true that there are a lot of really, really demanding bosses on Capitol Hill, would we be having this conversation if it was, say, a man?
Well, I guess we haven't had that conversation, really, because, for instance, John McCain, when he was running for president, he was noted to have a fiery temper. And yet no one was saying, that might be a problem for his leadership.
Right. And if you will recall, they were saying that about his vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin. There was a lot of conversation about how difficult she was to work with, how difficult she was to manage. That was more from the perspective of that you just couldn't kind of get her to do the things that you needed her to do at any given moment, and that she tried to kind of be in control of everything. But you did have that narrative kind of running through her place on the ticket where you didn't have that with Senator McCain.
I will say, though, that so far, several women have thrown their hat in the presidential ring, and we haven't heard those same allegations leveled at them, Senator Harris or Senator Warren.
That's absolutely true. And I've actually heard from people that I know that work on the Hill that Senator Warren, for example, is quite lovely to work for. And the people have said that Senator Klobuchar is really, really difficult. And the bigger question that I tried to address in a piece I wrote for the Post that I actually quoted Amy in is, should it matter? Does it matter that Senator Klobuchar might be a mean demeaning boss to be president of the United States? And so that's kind of an open question.
Well, Amy, should it matter?
Well, I do think it should matter. I think demeaning is a risky attribute of a leader. And now we want to keep in mind that many leaders are unaware of the impact they're having, right? In other words, their intentions are to motivate high performance, and they're unaware that they're being perceived as demeaning or mean or, in some way diminishing the humanity of the other person. That's not their intention. They don't mean it. So it does matter. And, and I think Senator Klobuchar and probably many others likely need coaching in how to really inspire and achieve the very best performance and results from their teams.
Okay, we'll leave it there. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Amy Edmondson teaches leadership and management at the Harvard Business School. Colby Itkowitz is a political reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you both.
Thanks for having me.
Another problem for the Democrats, an internal divide over Israel, the Palestinians, and what constitutes anti-Semitism. Today, a freshman Democrat, Ilhan Omar, apologized for an anti-Semitic tweet she made, but this was after being called out by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. To talk about that and the bigger issue, we have Mike DeBonis. He's a congressional reporter at The Washington Post. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, we'll talk about this back and forth between Nancy Pelosi and Congresswoman Omar. What happened?
Sure. So the sort of proximate conflict happened, started Sunday night when Ilhan Omar, who's a freshman lawmaker from Minneapolis, replied to a tweet talking about criticism of Israel and how much U.S. political leaders talk about Israel, and her comment was, it's all about the Benjamins, baby, which was pretty directly suggesting that the reason that American lawmakers care about Israel is because they get paid to do so. And then there was a follow-up where she fingers AIPAC, which is the biggest pro-Israel advocacy group in Washington, for essentially paying off lawmakers. And certainly to Jews and certainly to a lot of other non-Jewish allies of Israel in Congress, it's a pretty highly offensive implication, which is the only reason that they care about Israel is because they get paid to do so. And I think that for the vast majority of Congress, and people who consider themselves pro-Israel, all of them don't consider it about money. And it also, as has been repeatedly pointed out in the last less than 24 hours, this is really plays into ancient stereotypes, anti-Semitic stereotypes about rich people, rich Jews controlling the world.
And the politics and all that. And so Nancy Pelosi said today, okay, you need to apologize. And then she did.
Yeah, she just did. She said, I unequivocally apologize, but then sort of equivocated slightly by saying that she will continue to talk about the problematic role of lobbyists in our politics, whether it's AIPAC or any other industry.
Well, I guess my question is, what's wrong with that? I mean, a lot of people say that lobbying and money in politics is a problem.
Well, it's just, when you talk about Israel, you're dealing with a whole another level of sensibilities and sensitivities that isn't present when you're talking about gun control or fossil fuels or any number of other issues where people are critical of lobbyists. I think that I think there was a pretty good consensus today, a Republican and Democrat, that to suggest that people back Israel only out of financial concerns is certainly going well over the line. And basically, you know, what we're seeing in the Democratic Party is they're figuring out right now where is that line where an elected official can be critical of the policies of the Israeli state, the policies of the government now led by Benjamin Netanyahu, while not playing into anti-Semitic tropes without questioning the right of Israel to exist, so on and so forth. And that's a hugely tricky issue, and it's something that they're sort of feeling out in real time, and we're watching it happen.
Yeah, it's so interesting, especially because Congresswoman Omar is Muslim, as is Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, who is of Palestinian origin. And both of those women have been criticized mainly by Republicans, by Kevin McCarthy in particular, for, I don't know, anti-Semitic tweets or associating with groups who espouse anti-Semitic views, things like that.
Yeah.
Is it no accident that these are two Muslim women?
Well, it isn't an accident. I'm not going to go comment on that.
Is that part of it? Are they being targeted because
There's no way to say, I mean, there's no way to ignore the fact that, it's two Muslim women who are bearing the brunt of this criticism. There are others, I can name other lawmakers who have been critical of Israel who have come under criticism, Betty McCollum and the St. Paul, Minnesota. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez caught some grief for having a phone call with Jeremy Corbyn in Britain, who has been accused of tolerating anti-Semitism. They're not the only ones who are getting it, but they're certainly getting the bulk of it. And that is, something that is certainly not being ignored here. I think that up until last night, I think that there was a sense in among Democratic leaders and among Democrats generally that basically this was a Republican trolling effort, that they're trying to deliver this criticism in hopes of creating a reaction and perhaps distracting from what happened with Steve King or from whatever else is going on.
So is this an attempt to create a Democratic Steve King?
Kevin McCarthy and other Republicans have certainly drawn that parallel, have absolutely drawn that parallel. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're very forthright in saying, that they see the situations as comparable. And we should just say that Steve King had a long record of talking about immigrants and white nationalism and white supremacy in an offensive way. Certainly more a much longer record than either Tlaib or Omar have had. But I think that there was no way for Democratic leaders to ignore the subtext of what Omar had said on Sunday night.
Okay, so that brings us to this anti-BDS bill the Senate passed last week. BDS standing for Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions. And basically, from what I understand, what it would do is provide legal cover to states who say, look, businesses, if you want to boycott Israel, we're not going to support that. And we're going to, in effect, sanction you, right? And so Democrats were split on this. What does that mean?
Basically, the objections that we've heard among Democrats is that this is a free speech issue, that this is the federal government basically restricting what private entities can say and do. And, you know, that is the grounds on which you saw a lot of the Democratic senators, including many of these presidential candidates, oppose the bill. Very few Democrats have openly supported the BDS movement, and I don't expect a lot of or any presidential candidates to explicitly endorse it. But they were sending a message that they weren't going to allow this to be sort of demagogued and to have people's free speech rights abridged as a part of this broader conversation about Israel and what the proper, you know, role of the U.S. relationship is.
So basically, including California's two Democratic senators, they're saying, look, we're not going to necessarily get behind the BDS movement, but we're not going to stand in the way of companies who feel like they don't want to do business with Israel on these grounds. We're not going to say you can't do that, because who are we to say what you should and shouldn't do with your business? And it's a free speech issue.
I think that's right. And, you know, you saw there was one Republican, Rand Paul, who did oppose it on the same grounds. Basically, this is, you know, the federal government trying to coerce the state and local governments to discriminate against a viewpoint that they don't favor. And that's sort of the crux of the issue with this bill.
Okay. So do you expect this to just become a bigger political issue as the political campaign heats up?
Well, I do. I think that, you know, listen, President Trump has been reaching out very assiduously to American Jewish voters and making the case that he is a stronger supporter of Israel and than Democrats are. I think he's going to continue to do that. And I think certainly when you have controversies like this, you know, he's going to be talking about them. And there's a long campaign ahead where this could be a recurring theme.
Mike DeBonis, he covers Congress for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Coming up, analysis of the Supreme Court's latest abortion decision by our own legal Jessica Levinson, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to talk now about where the nation's highest court is on abortion. Certainly a hot button issue that a lot of us are concerned about. The Supreme Court has blocked a Louisiana abortion law. They did that last week from going into effect. And now we're all trying to read the tea leaves. What does this mean for the future of abortion rights? We're going to talk about that with Jessica Levinson, our regular legal on Mondays. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so John Roberts was the deciding factor in this decision. Talk about that. Talk about the decision and why he was the swing vote.
This vote means so much and so little at the same time. So when it comes to the Supreme Court, what most people think about, fairly or not, is the right to have an abortion and the right to access to abortion. And that's why this question dominates the confirmation hearings. We just heard so much about it when it came to now Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And so what this decision says is fairly narrow. It just says there's a Louisiana law. It restricts access to abortion. It essentially says to doctors, you need to be admitted in a hospital within 30 miles of your clinic in order to perform abortions. It's very, very similar to a Texas law that was just struck down by the Supreme Court 3 years ago. And all the court did on Thursday was say that Louisiana law, it doesn't get to go into effect until we determine what we're doing with this case. Basically, if we're taking the case, if we're saying, no, we decided this 3 years ago. And so all it does is essentially press, pause, and give breathing room.
So basically it's saying, lower courts, you go figure this out, and then we'll rule on the actual merits of this case.
Well, so the lower courts actually have figured this out. There's a trial court that ruled, no, this is not a permissible law, and they said, I'm looking at you, Texas decision. Mm-hmm. And then there's a Fifth Circuit decision, the Court of Appeals, and they said, in really what I think is an extraordinary decision, well, I know the trial court found all these facts and they said that the law wasn't permissible, but we as a Court of Appeals are going to kind of hop into their shoes and say, no, that's not true. And so now really the only next step is the Supreme Court. So we don't know if they're going to take this case or if they'll just write basically a one line that says, we made a decision 3 years ago, that decision still stands. But in terms of reading the tea leaves, what we know from Thursday's decision is that at the very least, John Roberts cares about not creating a huge jolt to the legal system now. What do we take from that? He cares about precedent. He cares, at least right now, he cares about the institution of the Supreme Court. He cares what people think of the Supreme Court.
Because he's saying, look, we do have this precedent. We need to respect it, no matter whether you agree with it or disagree with it.
Now, he may not be saying this if the court actually hears the case on the merits. On the merits means, is Louisiana's law constitutional or not? Now, in that case, he could say, I know we have a recent precedent, and then find some very nice and formal and legal way of saying, but I don't really like that precedent. And that's why I was in the dissent in that Texas case 3 years ago. He's going to have to find a really good way of saying that what changed is not just the composition of the Supreme Court.
What if they decide not to take it?
If they decide not to take it, then depending on exactly how it happens, essentially the Fifth Circuit decision could stand. And the Fifth Circuit,
which allows the law.
Right, which allows the law.
Which means a restriction, a major restriction on abortion access in Louisiana.
A major restriction to the extent that it could close, all but estimates are one or two of the clinics that provide abortions. Mm.
Okay, so what did Kavanaugh, Justice Kavanaugh, the newest justice, what did he say in his dissent?
So he dissented, and it was so interesting that he bothered to dissent because obviously this was such a big part of at least round one of his confirmation hearings. And so what Justice Kavanaugh did is he spent a lot of words. And basically, what do we take from that? We take that he felt he needed to write something to essentially defend himself, to explain in a number of ways why he thought it was okay for the law to go into effect while we take next steps. But the final outcome would be that the law would go into effect.
And when would we know, when they decide?
Well, so this would be a case that would be heard next term, not this term. This term is set except for potentially a question about the census and whether or not you can ask about citizenship. And so we could hear really at any time whether or not this is set for the term that would start in October 2019.
All right, let's turn to another story in the news now. The Justice Department trying to block a group in Philadelphia from opening up a center where people who inject drugs, like heroin or fentanyl, could do so under medical supervision, sort of safe injection sites, as they're known. And this was supposed to be the first one to open up in the United States. Why is the Justice Department trying to block it?
Well, the Justice Department is trying to block it because there is a so-called kind of, we call it a crack statute. This was part of the 1980s when people were trying to crack down on crack houses. And what it says is basically you can't create a space where people can sell or use, and that's really the key word here, illegal substances or illegal drugs. And this has been interpreted to apply to more than just crack houses, but it's never been applied to the specific instance where the safe injection site is designed basically to try and help people, to make sure that people don't overdose. And so this is a question between what the statute says, where I think if you look at the plain language of the statute, it really would prohibit this type of situation where you get to use illegal substances in the premises, that's what it's designed to do, versus the spirit of the law, which is really, again, a crackdown on crack houses, not a place where you're actually trying to have medical supervision and help people and make sure that they don't overdose.
But what if it's a legal drug? Fentanyl is legal.
So if it's a legal drug, meaning a permissible drug, then that's a different situation. But if it's an illegal drug,
like heroin, even though medically there's probably no difference,
then
that's another topic altogether.
This is a different topic. But then I think the statute, if you just look at it, would say, no, that's not okay. Now, what's interesting is the Department of Justice actually is taking a fairly incremental step. What it's doing is, this is a civil lawsuit, and it's saying to the nonprofit, you can't do this under the federal statute. What they could have done is wait for the nonprofit to open these safe injection sites and then start criminally prosecuting people. So I think that it is, frankly, kind of a middle ground step where they're saying we need to flesh this out. And they know that there are a lot of other jurisdictions who may want to do this.
Because, California, for example.
Exactly. Because there's been some evidence that's actually effective. There haven't been, I understand, kind of broad studies, but a lot of people are going to be looking to this and seeing kind of what can the lawyers come up with. And ultimately, of course, what is a judge going to say?
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Monday Legal Eagle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, our un-Grammys.
Arctic Monkeys, Beck, Bjork, David Byrne, St. Vincent. How do you compete with that category?
Who should have been nominated, according to our own music experts, KCW DJs Anthony Valadez and Eric J. Lawrence. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Grammys were handed out last night. Country star Kacey Musgraves won Album of the Year. Cardi B, Best Rap Album. Dua Lipa, crowned Best New Artist. All women. Well, today we are doing something different, too. We're going to give out the very first Press Play un-Grammys. Here to give us their thoughts on who should have been recognized by the Recording Academy last night are KCW DJs Eric Lawrence and Anthony Valadez. I spoke with them before the awards. Hi, guys.
Hey, how you doing?
Hello.
All right, Eric, let's start with you. And the category is Best Rock Song. Who is the winner of the Press Play un-Grammy?
So this comes from my favorite record of this past year. It is Parquet Courts. The album's called Wide Awake. The song I selected is Freebird 2, which is a little bit of a more mellow song for them. They're kind of a bit of an aggressive post-punk kind of a band. But this song is a little more restrained, and it has echoes of like Elvis Costello to my ears. I've learned how not to miss the age of tenderness that I am so lucky to have seen once. And now that I've become older, I've learned how to brush over my history and how it's sequenced. When I think about you, I see a person who hasn't existed for a long time. Before you started using, before I started choosing to do the same thing for the same reasons. Oh yeah, it does sound punky the way he sings. He's got a non-traditional good voice kind of a thing, and but with that organ and just sort of that bouncing bass line, it has sort of kind of that classic songwriter kind of vibe to it as well.
Okay, that's Freebird 2 by the band Parquet Courts. Anthony. Best alternative music album?
Out of Houston, I'm going to go with Krungbin. They're new. Arctic Monkeys, Beck, Bjork, David Byrne, St. Vincent. How do you compete with that category? I feel like Krungbin takes a little bit from each of these artists, but also they're inspired by Thai funk, and it's very guitar-driven, and it's different. You can't quite put it in a box, and that's my pick.
The song on my playlist.
Oh, yeah. You know what's up.
I do.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I do. I think I got it from listening to your show.
Of course.
That's how I get all my music. I just Shazam what I hear on KCRW. Okay, well, tell us about this, because it krungbin. What does that mean?
It translates into something in terms of, like, peace to the universe or something to that effect. But again, they're based out of Houston, Texas, heavily inspired by Thai funk. A lot of folks, you know, where are they from? They're from Houston. It's that simple. And, you know, it's just such a great sound, and it's different.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, back to you, Eric J. Tell us about best historical album.
So that's a category that's kind of important to me, because so much of the rest of it is dealing with the kind of the zeitgeist, newest of the new. This is an opportunity for the Grammy voters to kind of look backwards and get a little bit of history and context to it. My favorite reissue of last year comes from the record label Omnivore, which is a fairly recent great label specializing in reissues. It's Vince Guaraldi, the jazz pianist and keyboardist, and this is his complete Warner Brothers and Seven Hands recordings. Yes.
And I do know the way to San Jose, too.
Yes. As was typical for a lot of kind of jazz musicians in the late 60s, early 70s, they were doing a lot of pop songs. So this, of course, is the Burt Bacharach classic, Do You Know the Way to San Jose? Vince Guaraldi is best known to people as the guy that did the Charlie Brown Christmas music. And so he's done a number of other things. So this was a good way.
Which is kind of depressing.
Well, that's a whole nother segment here.
Exactly. But great, great music. I love that music. All right. So, Anthony, best R&B album.
I got to go with Blood Orange, Negro Swan. It's a record that we've been playing a lot here on KCRW. He's added sauce and flavoring to the likes of Tinashe, Solange, FKA Twigs, Florence and the Machine, Blondie, Mariah Carey. And I just feel like it's his time. He definitely paves the way and does something a little different and special. And I noticed that a lot of the pop world kind of takes from him, or, you know, calls him and says, hey, I need that sauce. And also, what's most important about this album is that he describes it as an exploration of into my own soul and many types of black depression and anxieties of queer and people of color. And the way that these struggles really seem universal in the way that he presents it, where I feel like anybody can enjoy this album. And I'm mad that it was snubbed.
Charcoal Baby by Blood Orange. That's just so lovely.
Isn't it?
It really is.
Very minimal, very soothing, but yet very effective.
Absolutely. Okay, Eric, best new artist.
So this is a category that has historically been most fraught for the Grammys, with picking things like Milli Vanilli, that whole scandal in the past. And like in 1979, they picked A Taste of Honey. Remember them? With Boogie Oogie Oogie. Picking them over people like The Cars and Elvis Costello, two Rock and Roll Hall of Famers.
So I do like Boogie Oogie Oogie.
Yes, but... so it's a really impossible category to really get right. It's too early to be able to determine who's the best new artist that's going to go on to do great things. But the guy that sort of caught my ear this year is a guy from Richmond, Virginia, named Andy Jenkins. And We'll listen to the title cut of his album, Sweet Bunch. Another thing that's relevant about it is, at some level, it's the producer that I think becomes the noteworthy new artist name. His name is Matthew E. White. He's released some records under his own name, but he's also made a name for himself as a producer and a contributor to many other artists' records as well. But he does appear on this record from Andy Jenkins. And all of my thoughts are your thoughts too. Don't get excited, we got nothing new, but it's a beautiful thing to know. In the crease and against the cold, keep them quiet and acting bold. Golden love never had a love of gold. What a lovely thing to know. My, my, all the boys are true, they're true as the wind.
Vocals are so recessed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of, I think, what Matthew E. White is doing. He gives an authenticity to it, but also gives it sort of a laziness with a celestial kind of backdrop to it. I think he could very well, Matthew E. White in particular, become sort of the next Dan Auerbach or Danger Mouse in terms of being kind of a producer of the moment. So he did a great job with this Andy Jenkins record.
All right, Anthony, another big one, best rap song. That's also controversial at the Grammys, usually.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at the contenders this year, it's Drake, Kendrick, Eminem, Travis Scott, J-Rock. What's missing? Woman. And especially last year has been incredible for artists like Rhapsody and so many other folks, but the one that stands out is No Name. And she has this cut called Blaxploitation. What I love is that she has an incredible cadence, passion, just as powerful as any Drake, Kendrick, Eminem record. And also, she's performing at KCRW's World Festival on June 16th with Chromeo and Tori Moore. Get your tickets.
Yes. Okay, that's at the Hollywood Bowl.
That's correct.
Okay, let's listen to No Name, and the song is called
Blaxploitation.
Pissing on Fetty the poop. Only the niggas that hoop. Trade them all up for cartoon. Dance, monkey dance. Cathedral gon' fit me good tonight. Eating Chick-fil-A in the shadows. That tastes like hypocrite. Yummy, tasty. Yummy, tasty. Waffle for my empathy. Bitches just really lazy. Maybe I'm not hypocrite. Maybe I'm hypochondriac. I'm struggling to simmer down. Maybe I'm an insomni black. Bad sleep triggered by bad government. But I think peace and the rats are on the new age covenant. If you really think I'm cooking crack and pass me the oven, Miss Captain, watch a little bitch. You go crunch and wonder how everything happened.
Oh my gosh, I am wrapped trying to figure out what she's saying.
Yeah, same here, but isn't it beautiful? It's, she's using her voice. He's writing that drum.
Yeah,
it's an instrument.
It really is, but I know she's saying something really important. I just want to listen to it over
Hillary
and over
Clinton.
Again. Yeah, you heard that.
That's the only thing I caught, really.
Okay, good enough.
Old.
Okay. All right, well, that brings us to the end of our first annual Press Play on Grammy Awards. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Eric J. Lawrence and Anthony Valadez, two stellar KCRW DJs. Coming up, the elusive, the mysterious, blue-eyed California coyote. We'll tell you about that animal next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Ah, yes, the familiar sound of a coyote. Most of us are familiar with it since we share our city with them. And we're also familiar with what they look like. The big ears, the black nose, the grayish, rust-colored fur, the yellow eyes. However, five coyotes have recently been spotted with blue eyes, but just here in California, nowhere else. They're not Game of Thrones White Walker coyotes. So what is happening? Callie Broaddus is a writer for National Geographic. Hi there.
Hi.
Okay, what is going on? Why do these coyotes have baby blues?
Well, it would be difficult to tell without DNA analysis for certain, but what we've been able to determine through various experts, conversations with scientists, is that what most likely happened is a few generations ago, a coyote had a unique genetic mutation to the genes that control eye color, and it gave it blue eyes, and several generations later, its descendants are starting to cross over each other. And now we're seeing that gene pop up.
More than just more. So not a one in a million chance, but more than that.
Well, ironically, we said one in a million 6 months ago when we had only found one of them, and it's unclear how many coyotes there are existing in the world today. But now that there are five, now that ratio is actually probably more accurate.
And where are they, these five?
So right now we know of two that live in Point Reyes National Seashore. Mm-hmm. We know of one in Sacramento and at least two in Santa Cruz. There are also sightings that are potentially blue-eyed coyotes in the Marin Headlands and other surrounding areas, but we haven't fully verified that they're not, you know, kind of grayish or just an odd cloudy day. So for sure we can say five.
So in Northern California, we haven't seen any here in Southern California yet.
No, they're all within about a 100-mile radius of each other up there near San Francisco.
Does that give you another clue that they perhaps are sharing similar parentage?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the only way that it could have happened. It would be extremely unlikely for this mutation to pop up uniquely multiple times. So what most likely happened is one coyote had a mutation, it bred, in dogs at least, we know that it's a recessive gene. So kind of like what you learn in elementary school with the Mendel's P experiment, and you have little recessive genes that eventually overlap. And when you have two recessive genes together, that's when you get the emergence of that trait, those mm-hmm. blue eyes. So it's only through overlapping coyotes who share a same ancestry or a same lineage to that original mutation that we see the blue eyes coming back out.
Any chance that this first coyote mated with a husky?
It is possible, but unlikely. So where we have seen coyotes interbreeding with domestic dogs, which is there's much more evidence of that out east, both in areas where there's a lot of pressure on coyotes and not a lot of choice to breed with other coyotes, and also in instances where breeders are actually intentionally breeding to create coy dogs. But out west, we have not seen that evidence of that. We do know that there were Australian shepherds in the Point Reyes region a while back. That's a very tenuous link because we don't know. They may have been neutered. We don't know if they were ever let out of the house, but we do know they existed. So I would say it's a very, very remote possibility. It is more likely that they just had a mutation. Still fascinating.
Is there any adaptive advantage to having blue eyes?
Usually no. And usually it would be the opposite, in fact. And that's why the coyotes you see today all have that golden yellow eyes. And that's because through natural selection, whenever you see a single trait emerge as a common trait throughout a species, it's because it's been selected for the best survival of that animal. However, coyotes have evolved over the last 800,000 years and beyond, and so they previously had the pressure of dire wolves and saber-toothed cats and more recently wolves and mountain lions, and those pressures are very much alleviated. So it is entirely possible that even if these blue eyes aren't advantageous and if they're not severely disadvantageous, it's possible that they'll be allowed to proliferate because of that reduced selective pressure.
Wow. They are really good looking, I'd say, with the blue eyes. I mean, they're really stunning.
Totally.
They look like Paul Newman.
Yeah, they are. I mean, eyes have a particular ability to draw someone in, and I think that's part of what's so exciting about this, because coyotes are vilified across the country, and even though they are so closely related to domestic dogs that they can even interbreed with them, people have grown up fearing them and misunderstanding them. And so I think having these images and the sort of just exciting development in the coyote world that as a potential to attract people to them, I think could potentially be a great thing for the coyote.
Kelly Broaddus, she's a writer for National Geographic. We've been talking about the five blue-eyed coyotes we know now exist here in California. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Well, that's a blast from the past, Christian Bordahl.
Hey there.
How are you?
I'm good, Madeline Brand. How are you?
True men don't kill coyotes.
No.
Okay, well, it has been really rainy, so I haven't really heard a lot from the coyotes lately. But that rain has translated into tons and tons of snow.
Incredible.
Literally, probably.
Incredible amounts of snow. I was just looking it up. You know, the Grapevine closed last night because there was so much snow in this latest storm. Mammoth just had 3 to 4 feet over the weekend. They now have a total of more than 300 inches, 25 feet of snow on the ground in Mammoth.
They're going to be skiing in August.
Absolutely. Yeah, or July at least.
I'm excited. Exaggerating, but maybe not. Okay, so you're gonna go?
I'm itching to go. I love going up there. Mostly to cross-country ski, though. That's kind of my bag. I mean, I do the downhill thing, too, one day, but I like to go cross-country skiing.
You are the resident Norwegian, after all. And you have lived up to your name by actually following winter sports on TV.
I do, yeah. I'm so thankful that there's this thing called the Olympic Channel now, because before that, you couldn't really get much winter sports, particularly cross-country skiing. Never showed cross-country skiing or speed skating or ski jumping. I know you're a big fan of the cross-country skiing. You don't have to let everyone know. It's all right.
It's not the most dynamic of things to watch.
It's beautiful.
It's nice to do. I like to do
movement
it.
To watch.
To watch it is
and it's really exciting.
Not exactly thrilling.
And it's a race. You know, they're racing against each other.
Yeah, but it takes forever.
It takes
anyway,
a while.
Anyway, let's talk about the downhill because there's Lindsey Vonn, right?
Yes. So Lindsey Vonn has, she's not going to ski anymore. She's retired.
Right.
But she went out in a blaze of glory. Mm-hmm. The World Championships are happening right now of alpine skiing. So that happens every couple of years. On odd years, you have these World Championships of skiing. And right now it's the Alpine Championships. Downhill, Super G, slalom. And
the
Lindsey
exciting
Vonn,
ones.
Yeah, they are
the ones
actually,
we want to watch.
Absolutely, they're exciting too. Yeah, I'll give you that. So Lindsey Vonn, 34 years old, had said, you know, this is going to be it for me.
Yeah.
And then in the first race, the Super G race last week, she crashed again.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked ugly. She went down into the netting hard. And they were showing pictures of her with a black eye and yada, yada. And then this weekend, she went and did the downhill and skied really well. I mean, she is just the bravest person. I mean,
she's considered the best skier ever, right?
Of women, definitely, yes. She's won more World Cup races than anyone else. Great, great skier. And she's just fearless, obviously, you know, because you're going 70, 80 miles an hour sometimes in the downhills. And after you've just crashed, you've got to be a little bit. But she went for it. And she won the bronze medal in the Alpine. And then we had Michaela Schifrin, who's the other American skier right now on the women's side, who's kind of taking over the mantle from her. And she won that Super G race that Lindsey crashed out in. The Americans
doing
pretty well.
So she's 23, so she's a bit younger.
She's 23.
She's got a lot of years
extraordinary,
to ski
extraordinary
and,
talent.
And beat up her body.
Absolutely, yes.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.